beat of their own drum. Some library directors never seem to understand why colleagues joined RLG. And conversely, some RLG librarians can't understand why their colleagues don't see the wisdom of joining RLG. Obviously, the profession needs to become more sophisticated in our assessments and more tolerant in our judgments. Library administrators must work harder to expand their campus spheres of influence and bases of support. This will not be an easy task because most campus communities are not in agreement on what needs to be done and what is the relative importance of each problem. Let me cite a few examples. Faculties in the humanities tend to attach greater importance to books and journals than they do to technological devices. But faculty from the College of Engineering may view this attitude as Ludditism. Administrators see only the continuing spiral in the cost of books and journals and wonder where it will all end. Humanists will undoubtedly support programs of preservation, only there will be disagreements on what to preserve, whereas scientists whose publications experience a short half-life of use may not view preservation as such a pressing matter. Administrators, though interested, may be scared by the sheer magnitude of the problem, and this could discourage them from taking decisive action, particularly when much needs to be done to refurbish and equip buildings and laboratories. Although technology may hold the key to a library's success, a computation-centered director can view the library as a competitor for resources. And again, humanists may oppose any plan that appears to divert funds from book budgets. Enlightened administrators understand the need for long-term investment in computers, and hopefully they will prevail. And finally, even networking and cooperation, long a popular topic among librarians, does not receive rave notices from all segments of the campus. Administrators may view cooperation as a panacea, not realizing that it has usually resulted in higher rather than lower operating costs. Faculty may support the concept of cooperation, but will oppose the notion of transferring resources to remote locations. Some are already beginning to question the rationale of shared collection development. Even the most skilled and persuasive librarian negotiator will not change the attitudes of some faculty and administrators. There are too many competing and often conflicting priorities facing university campuses. Nonetheless, if the library administrator is to succeed during the coming decade, bold action is required. If one adopts a laissez-faire posture or lets sleeping dogs lie, the greatest risk is that no action will occur, and that, in the longer term, would be the greatest tragedy for our institutions. Librarians must become more adept at campus politics, and they must engage more regularly in activities commonly labeled public relations. We must reach out to faculty and students who do not normally enter library buildings. We must develop better channels of communication with administrators, faculty committees, and the faculty at large. We must make a concerted effort to explain library issues in general, but always giving priority to those that have the greatest local implications. We must make clear how collaboration with other institutions can provide assistance, while making clear that library cooperation is by no means a panacea. We must also make abundantly clear to faculty and administrators what are the consequences of inaction. Few academics fully understand the consequences of not utilizing technology, of not implementing conservation programs, of not developing programs to share the responsibility and cost of collection development, cataloging, and resource sharing. Oftentimes, the only expertise that an administrator or faculty member can bring to a library problem is a personal experience or impressions based upon campus mythologies about the library. These experiences may be no more relevant than is often the training of today's library school students. Let me inject here one note of caution. Informing the campus about library problems will entail a certain element of risk. The lack of knowledge about library operations can lead to uninformed decision-making. Often with the best of intentions, an official, a Senate Library Committee member, can advance what appears to be a perfectly logical solution, but in fact, it is really incomplete and oversimplistic. If one does not handle such occasions delicately, there is a risk that an influential faculty member or administrator will become resentful when his or her solution is not wholeheartedly embraced. At the same time, there is a danger in exposing some of the library profession's idiosyncratic policies to public scrutiny. I'm referring to such professional actions as the adoption of AACR2, or the recent wrangling concerning how microform should be cataloged. Nor am I particularly anxious to engage in a dialogue on the costs of cataloging. It is an expensive, labor-intensive activity whose costs might not appear justified to scholars and administrators. But the day is fast approaching when such discussions must take place. Are we prepared to justify practices or activities that we as a profession have long taken for granted? In the future, I suspect we will be subjected to greater scrutiny and held more accountable for our actions and our decisions. This will make life uncomfortable at times for many of us. I have focused my attention on the need to acquire additional financial resources, but I would like to conclude my remarks with a few words on an issue that may prove to be even more challenging. I am referring to the need to convince library users to change their attitudes toward libraries and their services in light of the changes that now appear inevitable. For libraries to respond to the problems I have enumerated, some sacrifice in privileges and reduction in direct access seem unavoidable. Unless faculty accept the longer-term consequences of current policies, there is a danger that they will become aroused and oppose programs of change. Convincing faculty and students to accept restrictions in current convenience of access may not be easy. At Michigan, we are currently selecting books for relocation into a new campus shelving unit. Some departments have given us full cooperation, where a few, and I'm happy to report very few, have become arbitrary and taken stands insisting that no books or journals among those of potential interest to them are to be transferred. Since a library stack is of finite capacity, obviously, some books must be transferred or no new books added. In the process of making choices, there is a danger that departments will pit themselves against each other, thus invoking a Darwinian approach to problem solving. That is, the fittest and the most influential department shall prevail. The opposition against book storage once again underscores how fragile the sense of community among scholars can become during a period of decline in resources. The problems, no matter how large, will prove reasonably tractable if we are successful in convincing our campuses to support well-reasoned plans. And eventually, faculty will realize that it is only enlightened self-interest to support the library as it endeavors to adopt labor-saving technological devices and accept policies that will contribute to the physical longevity of collections. Attitudes will change as campuses become better informed, and this process will be hastened if library and its staff become part of the mainstream of academic life. We cannot assume that the problems before us will simply resolve themselves. Certainly, they will not. We have a classic situation where we either hang together or we will hang separately. Solutions are possible only if all segments of the university collaborate, and further, only if groups of institutions can collaborate in ways they judge to be mutually beneficial. I began my presentation with a short recitation of the woes facing higher education. I did so because I am particularly concerned about the current situation. I believe a financially healthy, intellectually vital campus environment is a prerequisite to the long-term organizational health and vitality of campus libraries. To solve our problems, we scholars, librarians, and academic officials must become more adept at managing an environment which is highly interdependent and extraordinarily complex. Thank you. I'll make one further comment. Penny made the comment about 28 years old. I happen to be in that time of life where, and sometime in the place in the mid-40s, the eyes don't work very well, either short or long. And I was trying to go to the long view.
No, that's your job.
With the emergence of new technologies and new services, the question posed by Dennis Smith from System-Wide Administration is, how does one allocate scarce resources, what yardstick, what philosophical stance, et cetera, et cetera?
I don't believe that we've been able to develop adequate yardsticks to guide us in making choices. And I'm not sure I can give you a simple answer, Dennis. I think different universities, different institutions make these choices quite differently. In some systems, such as the University of California, there's been more of a tendency to seek formulas that will provide or help make the judgment. In other universities, they're more inclined to see how their peers are making out. What trends do they see? But I don't believe we're going to find easy answers. I think it really falls back on what one views as quality. How does one judge whether or not students are getting a quality education? What determines what is a quality university? We have some yardsticks, and I think one of them happens to be the campus libraries. It's my thesis, quite frankly, that I think universities, in their efforts to compete for the best young faculty at a time of high costs of relocation, probably are not placing sufficient emphasis on the resources of their university libraries. And I think in California, you're in an admirable position to make this case. I think that's one of the advantages of cooperation. On the other hand, there are some equally compelling advantages to be able to design one's services more closely to meet the primary needs of the campus constituencies. And sometimes these two extremes are in conflict. On the, there's another part of your question. Well, I think just by and large, no one's going to find any easy answers. And as I mentioned, on most campuses, there probably is no consensus on what needs to be done and which choices are to be selected. I was going to comment on Wilf Lancaster's view of the paperless society. I have great respect for him, and I think he's one of our profession's most able thinkers. I don't believe, however, that we're going to see the changes in libraries that he anticipates. I believe it's one of the laws of organizations that they must maintain a certain semblance of stability. And I believe that the move toward the paperless society, whatever that means or signifies, will be much more evolutionary than many suspect today. And at the same time, I would imagine that in some parts of the world, that the volume of paper form publications will actually increase rather than decrease. I think what we are going to see is simply more options available in dealing with transmitting and making information available. I think in this case, it provides us with exciting opportunities, much along the lines that Penny was talking about. I think, again, it's dangerous for people to be lured into assuming that the day of the library is about over, because this is will tempt people to defer actions that need to be taken, hoping that the future will simply remove the problem. I can remember in library school, Fremont Ryder was talking about the microfilm library replacing paper publications, and you can now see 30 years later what's really happened.
Now it is my pleasure to present the third speaker of our afternoon colloquium, Stuart Forth. Stuart received his baccalaureate in English Literature and History from the University of Michigan. He followed the baccalaureate at Michigan with a Master of Arts in Library Science from the same institution. And later he took a PhD in American History from the University of Washington. He's held a variety of posts in libraries. Like Penny and Richard, he has worked in the public library sector. He began his library career as a student assistant, 1946, in the University of Michigan Engineering Library. Following his graduation from Michigan's library school, he worked for 4 years at Oregon State, first serving 2 years as a cataloger, and then assuming administrative responsibilities. In 1955 through 1959, he went to Seattle and served as a reference librarian in the Seattle Public Library. In 1959, he came back into academic libraries, moving to the state of Kansas to become undergraduate librarian at the University of Kansas. Later, during his tenure at Kansas, he assumed the title Assistant Director of the libraries at the University of Kansas. Following his post at Kansas, he moved to Kentucky to become director of university libraries from 1965 through 1973. In 1973, he moved from Kentucky to Pennsylvania to become dean of libraries at Pennsylvania State University, a post he currently holds. During the same period of time, he has been a faculty member at the University of Washington as a teaching fellow in the Department of History, a professor in the Department of Western Civilization at Kansas, and a professor of library science at the University of Kentucky. I want to quote very carefully now two excerpts from his resume in his own words, describing some other employment. Served as a soldier in World War II, which not only interrupted my education, but probably prolonged the war's conclusion anywhere from 6 to 8 months. Full-time, 2-year psychiatric aide, University of Michigan Neuropsychiatric Institute, a job which, with all due respect to the library school, prepared me better for the rest of my career than any other experience I had. Presently, Stuart is serving as the elected chair of the Council of Academic Deans at Pennsylvania State University, the first time the library dean has held that post. He has been active in the library profession, serving, as has Penny, as chair of the university library section of ACRL. He has also served on the committee of academic status for librarians. He chaired that particular committee. He was recently president of the Pennsylvania Library Association. He's held membership in ACLU, the Organization of American Historians. It is a distinct pleasure at this time to present our third speaker, Dean Stuart Forth. Stuart.
Thank you, Carol. Ladies and gentlemen, it is a pleasure to be here in Sodom by the Sea. I always like coming out and seeing how the luxurious, idle, comfortable, suntanned other half live. Quite seriously, I feel at this meeting something like a representative of the third world. I really have deep down in me not only a touch of Calvinism, but a strong dose of populism, and I want to address that. I have trouble generally perceiving myself as an Idi Amin or a Mobutu or a Gaddafi until I come to a place like UC Irvine or UC Berkeley or the University of Michigan or any RLG meeting that I may attend. I always feel that here I am from an impoverished rural land-grant institution standing around bewailing the problems and the plight of the very rich. And this kind of puts me off a little bit. Mrs. Abel has given us a very good talk, a statesmanlike thing on broad philosophical considerations that we as librarians must address ourselves to. Dr. Doherty gave a professional response to specific academic considerations that affect all research institutions, but by no means all academic librarians. And I have been sitting up here. When you're the third speaker, you have two choices. You can tear their speeches apart and point out how wrong they are, or you can stick to your original ones, editing like mad because they've already said some of your best things. I've been doing both. And one of the things that I must find myself talking about are some of the things that librarians, and librarians as a group, and librarians as a unique professional body of men and women may want to think about doing that has nothing to do with the broad philosophical approach of Mrs. Abel or the considered intellectual understanding approach of Dr. Doherty, but rather that has to do with, if you will, some gut fighting and some political brawls and some troublemaking that perhaps we may want to consider. I'm not here to chant a palinode to the past, nor rattle any of our sacred icons, but I do find myself, as I said, in this sort of situation, with a sense of frustration that we tend, as librarians, to sort of sit around and wring our hands and response to things that are being done to us. Horace Walpole, one of my most favorite authors, and I wish I could say he was a mentor, commented without attribution to the Countess of Ossory that the world is a comedy to those that think. It's a tragedy to those that feel. Mostly I think, and I find the world an amusing, entertaining place in a grim sort of way. But sometimes I feel rather strongly, and I feel rather strongly about the profession I'm in and what is happening to it, and who is causing it to happen, and who is failing to do something about it when they ought to do so. We are, as a profession, we all agree that, like the Vatican and Rolls-Royce, we change only when it is absolutely necessary. We do not change before, and we do not change much. That has, in effect, caused us certain problems. On the other hand, it may be good. It certainly has been good in the case of the Rolls-Royce, which is better than it ever was. I won't comment about the Vatican. I tend to be Anglican in my sympathies and don't want to get into a political row. But we are slow to change our educational habits, for example. I have been struck how down through the years we have not basically changed our own education. On this very campus, judging based on public information, 24 of the librarians hold the two basic degrees, the BA, the MLS. 17 of them hold a subject master's and the MLS. 7 of them hold the doctorate. Those same proportions could almost be addressed to my own university. And I submit that the upgrading of education for librarians is something that is our responsibilities, not anyone else's, and that we are simply going to have to do that. We know that the ARL, the Association of Research Libraries, and the Center for Library Resources is examining the whole problem of library education, but this is about us, and this is about our younger colleagues and our future successors, and I think we must all be very concerned about doing something about that if within the Academy we want to have the kind of clout that we presently bemoan the fact that we do not have. Parenthetically, I would like to say this is one of my green notes, which means that I put it in while one of those people was speaking. We all use, when we talk about research libraries or the researcher, we all use the best of the lot, the brightest and the best. We forget that, according to the Chronicle of Education, the vast majority of faculty in American institutions of higher education do no research and do little or no publishing. We forget the fact that most faculty don't really care about the library one way or another. We overlook the fact that neither do most students care about the library one way or the other. And most administrators, if they are not actually hostile, they are at best indifferent, though, and to me this convention or this meeting to date has been a red letter day, nobody has got up here and fatuously referred to the library as the heart of the university. I will be waiting all evening to hear what Professor Schlesinger might say. But I mentioned this because we take the absolute ideal. We take a Salk or a Nobel Prize winner or an Almquist, one of my own faculty who recently won a big hunk of the Woof Award that is given by the State of Israel and pays almost as much as the Nobel Prize. Professor Almquist was involved with very basic research in artificial insemination of bulls, which at my university is very important. I would also note that it is equally important to race horses, and the racing industry paid my salary for many years. The But we, our education, or maybe it's our profession itself, it's basic conservatism. Maybe it's the kind of people we are. I normally describe myself in public meetings when I'm to be a speaker that, you know, I am a meek, mousy male librarian. I don't want to make any waves or anything like that. But we are very inept politically at the national level, at the regional level, at the state level, and on campuses, which is one of the reasons that I think librarians themselves have got to get their act together rather more than they have in the past. Our administrators, what can I say about it, our administrators? I've been an administrator. Cal didn't mention it, but I served for several years as a vice president for student affairs during the halcyon days of the late 60s. But I did learn from that something about priority setting in universities. I am presently deeply involved at the highest level of administration at my own university, and I'm learning even more. I won't say that universities are primarily, the administrators are experts in crisis management, but I will say that their approach to priorities is often less than what we as librarians and what the few really top-notch scholars in any given institution would like it to be. They do respond to pressure, they respond to all kinds of outside pressure, they respond to what is fashionable, they respond to what the students want. We are all getting into a tuition-driven mode, and if 1,000 extra students show up to take accounting, the university says providing faculty for those accounting students is our highest priority. If at the same time 900 show up unexpectedly to take engineering, they say we must have faculty in the classrooms to teach the engineering. This is not planned priority making. And the library, of course, never has that kind of thing to hit the administration with it. We must also, I think, as librarians, seriously consider the changing nature of research. Mrs. Abel touched on that, and so did Mr. Dougherty. Neither of them mentioned what I think is one of the most important books that's come out in the last year or two, and that's Charles Osborne's book on, I'm a great little librarian, I don't have a complete citation, but Charles Osborne's book on the changing nature of research in libraries. That is something we are all concerned about, and I wanted to interrupt Dick Dougherty and read from him very briefly. These are from the minutes of the Research Policy Committee at my university. The Dr. Roy they refer to is a man who is in a named chair, has a national, international reputation in materials research, and so on. And this is a brief quote. Dr. Roy explained that the materials research laboratory faculty rarely have the need to use the library and find other ways of accessing information. For example, current contents, reprints, long-distance xerography, and computer searches. He cited a recent article, Prospects for Research Libraries in Science, which I brought along and which I fail to see does anything but prove my point, not his. And Dr. Roy suggested decentralization of the library in certain technical science areas and felt a subcommittee should be appointed to investigate this problem. The vice president for research noted that the technology is here and the cost of maintaining a library is rising. The vice president for research asked that this idea be brought to the attention of the college executive committees. If favorable feedback is received, a subcommittee will be appointed. Dr. Roy went to that meeting with about as many facts as the average lynch mob, and as such, demonstrated to his colleagues in the libraries, who are very irritated by that, and they are planning a response, not I, pointing out that perhaps he'd better take a look at how far along we already are with our total computerized efforts, which will indeed be a dispersed method of accessing information, dispersed not only on our own campus, but to the 21 other campuses that are part of our library system. I mention that, however, because it is the sort of thing that we are faced with. A strong research professor, without any facts to back him up, makes a big noise in an important committee and has practically everybody in the administration building dithering because we must keep Professor Roy happy at any cost. And this is the sort of thing that librarians, you all, and my people, should be leaping in as a group, a professional group. At my university, it is the University Libraries faculty, and raising holy hell about it. We have not done enough of that sort of thing. I'm just trying to skip here so that I will not keep you too long. As one of this particular article in Science, it was an editorial, pointed out, so many of the things we do cause us to have to do other things. We are kind of a victim of our own success. And we turn to our traditional allies to give us a hand on that sort of thing. And recently, in the Journal of Academic Librarianship, whose editor is here, there was a thing on the Faculty Library Committee's report to the administration at the University of Connecticut. A terrifying thing. You read it, and I am sure the president of Connecticut is trembling. He is unquestionably planning to resign. He cannot live with the vigor, the power shown, the indignation of that Senate Library Committee. If he reads their report at all, he's wasting his time. And that is normally true. I know Professor McCullough is here. I know his personal concern. But generally speaking, we cannot look to our colleagues in the collegial faculty ranks to do more than say, oh, we want to help you. We're for you. We're behind you, way behind you. It's your responsibility to do something about that. And I submit that we have some real problems here. Administrators say libraries are bottomless pits, they're too expensive. They themselves are not really professional administrators. And if I have time later, I will talk about the amateur status of all of us. They keep trying improved management efforts, hoping that will not only improve the university as a whole, but the library. And the librarians leapt on the bandwagon. We remember Dick DeGennaro's elegant article in which he summarized a program of evaluation, review techniques, and management by objections, and PBS, and Theory X and Theory Y. And my people are now coming talking to me about human resources development and action research models and organizational development. And French and Bell is a name we genuflect in my library when we hear. But nothing changes the fact that the libraries must be run, and here's where I'm getting to the political part of my talk. They must be run like every other unit in the library, in my thinking, within a political framework. And I do not use political, and these three colleagues at the table have heard me on this before. I do not use political in a pejorative sense. I use it in the Aristotelian sense of the art of the possible. But we do have to work out some way to improve and extend the use of technology when we have been hampered by the fast pace of the development of technology and the general lack of standardizations. When the costs of hardware and software are with us, when the obsolescence rate is high, by the abysmal ignorance of the field by 95% of us librarians, is that too high? Out here, maybe it's only 90%. In my part of the country, I have very, very few people who are librarians to whom I can turn and say, this is the problem, solve it. We are also fraught with the fact that our success rate is not very high to date. We're long on promises, but very few of them have been developed. And of course, the inability of the networks to get together and work out something that would be acceptable to everybody is known to our presidents and to our vice presidents for academic affairs and so on. This is, of course, conditioned by the fact that we do have, all of us have learned on the job. And when I say all of us, I mean everybody. Our presidents are drawn from academic disciplines. I am presently on a search committee for a new president for my university. Already we are hearing from the faculty, we must have a man who has been actively involved recently in publishing, in scholarly research, and so on. They say nothing about his knowledge of computers, of politics, of fundraising, of relations with the federal government. Those are not important. Our faculty, we may have a man with us who is the world's foremost expert in the saga of Beaufric the Brizling, is not an expert in anything else. If you need to know the development of the Brizling scholarship from the 10th century on, he knows it. He can share it. But when it comes to really, and Doherty touched on this, any real understanding and comprehension of the complexities that are facing our profession now, they simply do not have it, even men of the best will in the world. And many of our librarians, I regret to say, are amateurs too. Some of my most attractive librarians, the people I most like to have lunch with and have to my parties and go juicing it up with, may well be described as dilettantes. I do not have them working on the standards and the protocols of the computer. And this is not true just of my particular libraries. The role of governance is another concern of librarians, and I won't take time, but we do wonder who's in charge. Can you lay all this on Mr. Boyer, who's only been here a year? I strongly urge you, Cal, as long as you can, say, I'm new here. I don't understand it. I've got away with it for 8 years at Penn State, and they're still buying it. Where are the loci of power? How do you cope with the diffusion of authority, and do you as librarians understand it? The question came up, who determines priorities? Where do you get your input put in? My university recently, being very current, decided to notice the fact that women are demanding certain things, and they appointed a commission on women. The largest number of faculty women at the entire university are in the university libraries, and no woman from the library was appointed to that committee. I much admired two of the I don't know how many women I've got. I do know 65% of my faculty are women because affirmative action approves that. Two of them had already written the president very strong letters. They did not ask me if they could do it. They did not send it through channels. Their point is, you know, what the hell is this? And I much admire that. How many of you do that? How many of us do it when it comes to university priorities? I think we owe it to ourselves as professional people to take collectively a much more active role rather than always the passive one. Maybe the faculty will help us. Maybe the president will notice us. Maybe the friends of the library can exert a little pressure somewhere where it should be. Mr. Doherty spoke on university governance, in a sense. I won't go into that. But I would like to touch a little bit go back a bit to education for librarianship. We do have to sort it out. We have to refine our own role. We have to learn how to live with the computer people. It disturbs me considerably when I find that I am paying considerably higher salaries to a number of my computer staff than I am to long-term librarians. Somehow this seems wrong to me. Now, it's true these people do not have certain of the fringe benefits the librarians have. They don't have access to sabbatics. They don't have